Everybody, this is another episode of the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And let me tell you something. I have someone on here that, of course, many of you will consider a legend, a living legend, to be very honest, Hall of Famer. That is Greg Hill. And I just want to say, Greg, to you, thank you for giving me the time to sit down and talk to you and get to know you as a person.
You're welcome. It's cool. I appreciate you doing this. It's very cool.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. I think the question that I want to ask you is this. When did you get on a BMX bike, and what were your first feelings about being on that bike?
I'm going to say that was, I mean, we're talking BMX, so I'm just going to speak in general, basically. Mm-hmm. It would have been a Royce Union. I don't know if you remember that name.
No, sir.
But Royce Unions were just, you know, like some bike you'd see in equivalent to what you would see in Walmart today, you know?
Yeah.
Just a cheap street bike with big old ape hanger handlebars. I mean, the reason I'm mentioning that is because it's the bike that I had. I was 3 years old, and basically it was kind of like one of them girls bikes where the tube goes really low down so you can kind of straddle it real easy.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably close to four, but I know I wasn't four yet, and I got on that thing and rode and crashed my brains out. And then, from that point forward, I was on the bike every day in my little neighborhood, you know. And some people might say, well, 4 years old, 3 years old, how are you? Look, you know, when you're that age, you're not thinking about much other than what you want to do. You're not thinking far enough ahead to think maybe it's not a good idea, but I've done a lot of things in my life that maybe weren't good ideas to other people. So I started riding that bike and rode it all the time. When I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, just going all around the neighborhood. When I was 10 years old, I had a friend that was a friend of mine in school, and he was actually going to the races, organized races. And so one day he was like, we were riding, and he's like, hey, you need to come with us and check it out. So I just went and watched him, you know, and it was great. And that's kind of sort of when I started, it was 10 years old, and I did my first race at a place called Escape Country. I'm not sure if you want me to go far into that, but that's kind of like, you know, most people, when they say, hey, when is your, you know, the first time you rode a BMX bike, like when they might be thinking, oh, you had your number plate and you're this and that. But I mean, I had this bike and I just started riding it. And I'm 58. I'll be 59 here in about 6 weeks. And I've been riding a bike since I was for the last 55 years, I guess, or 56 years, pretty much most of my life, you know?
Wow. You grew up in Santa Ana?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Santa Ana, right. I mean, Santa Ana is a kind of a bigger city, but it was like right on the border of like Santa Ana, Garden Grove, Westminster, that area.
Were you like most kids just riding around the neighborhood and just enjoying yourself?
Yeah, pretty much was riding around the neighborhood. And as, you know, like example, as I was probably 7, 8 years old, I mean, life's different, man. I have five grandkids and four kids now, and I wouldn't let any of them at the age of 7 just hop on their bike and just ride off into the sunset. And, you know, when I was 7, man, I'd get on my bike and I was just gone, man. I was in the neighborhood.
Yep.
All the people I hung out with were like older kids. So I was 7. They were probably 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, and they were riding bikes. There was no thought of racing. It was, we're riding bikes. There's a field over there. We're going to jump that little mound. And if we were lucky, someone had a shovel and other kids were, but we would hit the same jump 5 million times and just do it over and over and over. And it was just riding around the neighborhood. You know, that's pretty much what it was.
Your first race, you talked about it, was Escape Country Track. It was 10 novice, if I'm correct, and you got fifth place.
Yeah, that was, I think I actually, you know, I was thinking about this because a few times in the last few years, people have asked me. I think I wound up getting third place. It was a really stupid deal, what I did. You know, we went to this race, and my buddy brought me, my buddy brought me to WSA to watch. And after that, I'm like, all right, this is it, man. I'm racing. So the next time he's like, hey, we're going to Escape Country. Let's go. Wow. My parents were fine with that. So I went to Escape Country and they had 10 people on the starting gate. And, you know, I don't remember all the specifics. I don't remember motos and how many kids. I just know the main event came around and I was in it. And somewhere, I don't know what place I was in. I wasn't out front. I was probably mid-pack in it. But everyone crashed. When I say everyone, there was 10 people in the race, and nine people crashed. And I was in the first turn, going through the turn by myself, and look back and see everybody on the ground. Well, amongst everybody on the ground was my buddy Tim Gallego, who happened to bring me out, you know. And I turned around. And I rode back down the track backwards and I got to him. I'm like, are you all right? He's underneath a pile of bikes and people and he's yelling at me like with everything he has, you idiot, turn around, go. And, so I turned around. By the time I turned around and went, I think I wound up getting some, maybe I got fifth. I probably got like a participation, not a participation. They gave first, second, third place trophies. Maybe they gave something else out. I got something like a ribbon or something like that. But yeah, I got fifth place and it was cool because basically it was the early on. I didn't know anybody. I had no clue who anybody was. My biggest memory of that race wasn't my race. It was actually watching the 14 and over. I don't know if it was, I don't even know if there was expert and novice intermediate back then. I don't think that there was. I was just watching the 14 and over class, sitting on my bike and I'll never forget watching, John George basically won the final and they had a track record, you know, like they would have like the fastest lap set by so-and-so. So I'll never forget watching his race and he won his main and then the announcer said he just beat Brian Lewis's track record by 5 seconds.
Wow.
And you know, like 5 seconds is a freaking lot, man. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And, so that was kind of like the first real experience and it was fun. You know, there wasn't, it's not like, I'm not going to say BMX is like this because it's not. You can't take a kid out to the track right now and have him be 14 years old and win his main event and have him think, wow, I can really go far in this. Like, and not like if you're playing football and you're in like 11th grade and you're really great and you're saying, all right, college and maybe pro, but there's no opportunity in BMX like that. So, and there never has been. But like, for instance, when you were back then, there wasn't anyone to look to. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a history of the sport. It was all being born right then. So like no one raced it or even thought about, oh, this is great, man. I can make a future. You're just going and having fun. You know, it's pretty much what it was.
So were you, since there was no one to really look at, were your heroes or people that you looked up to, were they the guys around you?
I don't think so. I don't really have any kind of memory of having a hero. I never really had one. It's like I never looked at stuff and thought, oh, that guy, man, he's so awesome and this and that. It's not like I didn't think they were awesome. They just weren't a hero. I never thought the mindset of having a hero. I remember when I was young, I didn't. When I was a little few years later, I mean, like probably 12 years old, I remember David Clinton. David Clinton would be the guy that I would say, hey, he was like the guy that I looked up to.
Yeah.
The first guy I looked up to and thought, wow, man, that dude is cool. I want to be like that guy, you know? But it was because you would go and you would see literally everybody riding these, you know, just shitbox bikes. Sorry, everybody's bike was just, you know, duct taped, bent, all different colors. Your Stenbroke, you put this one. It was just riding bikes that were just homegrown in your garage, wearing t-shirts and jeans and some helmet, maybe like you just, it wasn't pro looking.
Yeah.
And then you just seen this dude named David Clinton hop right up on this really cool Kawasaki with a full uniform and won the NBA number one plate. And he was just pro, man. He was like, it would be like going to a race today and looking at the elite guys. And there's one guy that dressed normal, like the normal, what you're used to seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then all other seven guys had torn Levi's and t-shirts and their bikes were just shabby looking. It was that much of a difference. So you couldn't help but look at the guy and think, wow, that's cool, man. I want to try to do that one day, you know? But that was pretty much the only real, I never really had any, I never really had the hero thing. Whenever I seen somebody was in a place I wanted to be, I didn't look at him as a hero. I just looked at him as a dude, I want to go kick that guy in the head and knock him off of there so I can get up there. Like, you're in my way. That's kind of how I looked at it, you know?
I love the attitude. That's awesome. Did you progress quickly?
Not really. You know, like the racing in Escape Country was like, okay, everybody crashed. I could have just coasted to the finish, but I turned around, so I screwed that deal up. Then I went to Western Sportsarama, mm-hmm. and I raced, and it was kind of like, you know, always mid-packing, and finally, one day, it's like, I got a trophy. I got second place, right? And what sucks about it is that I was 10 years old, got second place. If you were a girl, you got to race one age down. So I'm 59. My wife is 8 months older than me. So I'll be 59. She's 59 now. I turn 59 October. She turns 60 in February. So she's 8 months older than me. The reason I mention her is because she was racing in the 10-year-olds, even though she was 11.
Wow.
And I got second behind her, which sucked. Cause I mean, if you think about being 10 years old, and if you can try to wrap your head around the emotion of getting beat by a girl, it's a double-edged sword. You just did the best you've ever done, but you got beat by a girl. And now you're behind the bleachers and you're crying.
Oh, man.
And you know, so let's do that for another 4 months and just get smoked every night. Wow. That I went out. And then, you know, like, I don't know how long it was. It's hard to remember. It seems like another lifetime ago, but it would have been 3-4 months later. We had a race where we just dead heated. They gave us both first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And even that was totally bogus because it's like, I can't beat this chick. It's like, I got second behind her. She's been smoking me forever. We got a dead heat. They gave us both first, but it's not first because only one guy can get first. So I'm still bummed out. And then the next week I got first place and it was like awesome. So
we'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Okay, so I've got to ask you this question.
Yeah.
Was it fate for you and your wife, Liz?
I believe so. I mean, when I went to the track that first time, the WSA, I was just, you know, I was just rolling up in jeans and a t-shirt. She had a, you know, she rode for Matthews and she rode for Webco and she was established. And, you know, I went, it was WSA, Western Sportsarama. It was kind of a place that it had batting cages and a snack bar and then had this open area where you would call it. It might have been like, you know, it's not exact, but just an example. It might have been 60 feet wide and, you know, 100 feet long.
Yeah.
And it was asphalt. And that would have been like where people rode around, staged up. And then in the back corner, like you would head on up to the starting hill and take off. So when I went in there, first time I seen her, she was sitting in the middle of this group. And then and the guys around her were like, you know, 13 years old. And I'm like, you know, the difference between a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old is like, dude, you're 10 years old. You know, it's like another generation.
Yeah.
You know? So, but like Jeff Utterback, Brian Lewis, Kurt Malin, like all these dudes that were like, you know, after I got going, I knew who they were, you know? Mm-hmm. They were like friends with her and stuff. And then we raced each other and then we, started to hang out and, you know, at like 10, 11, 12, 13, we hung out, you know, we hang out over in the bushes and make out and, you know, she would come stay at my house and I'd stay at her house. It was cool, you know, but ultimately at, she was from LA, close to Highland Park, close to Pasadena area. And I was in Santa Ana. So, you know, if I say this now, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I can get there in 45 minutes. But when, again, if you go back in time, when you're 10, 11, 12,
yeah.
that seems like another state. It's so far away. You have no way to get up there. You have no way to visit. So we hung out, but life just kind of like, she got out of BMX. She was doing track and field.
Yeah.
And, so basically she got out of, I went on tour in 1977. I was 13.
Wow.
And I went on this SE tour for 6 weeks. And that basically kind of like while I was gone on tour, she kind of parked the bike and got into track and field and she did her thing. And we really kind of just kind of went our own ways. We really didn't, we might have talked a little bit here and there, but we kind of just grew apart, if you will, you know?
Yeah.
And, man, the next time I heard from her, it was my phone rang at my house. I just bought a house and I was getting married in 1 week. And apparently she called GHP, which was in Garden Grove. And my mom answered, gave her my home phone. She called me and she's like, how you doing? And I'm like, oh, man, and I'm getting married next week. And so we talked for a few minutes. And what was really kind of before that took place, I don't know if you want me to go all into this, but
yes,
So like before that, I did see her again, but what happened was we were racing the NBA Grand Nationals in Long Beach and, was at a college, like a football field, you know, and they put the NBA built the track in that. So we were racing that race. She showed up with two of her friends and she was walking around and I was just so stupid. I was like so into the race. I was racing pro and I was racing also, I think they let you race your, you get to race your amateur class and you got to race your, or no, I was racing pro open. I was 17 years old. That's what it was. I was racing pro open pro and, she showed up right as before the mains were going. So I just was like, I just said hi and I was so short. I was just thinking about winning the race. And then after that happened, she left thinking, well, and the only reason she went there was to try to see if I was there and she wanted to talk to me and I kind of blew her off.
Wow.
Because I was just so stupid thinking about the race, you know. I wound up winning everything that day and I was like, you know what, thinking years later I would have like gladly just parked my bike and walked away with her and just forgot about the race. But, you know, when you're younger, you don't think that way. So then it was only a couple of years later she called and, oh, I'm getting married next week. And after that, she never called me again. And, which I don't blame her. And so what she did is she wound up in a relationship. She didn't get married, but she wound up having a son named Lauren, who's my stepson now. When he was 5 years old, I came into his life.
Yeah.
And basically we raised him. He's 35 now, 35, 36. But what happened was, I got married and I was married, you know, that 1 week later, I'm getting married deal. I got married. And 8 years later, wasn't married. And after, you know, after going out here and there and dating and just like, this is sucks. This is just the worst. Like, I just was like, there's nobody else I can relate to other than Liz. So I got, I called her home phone, which was the same phone number it had been for years and years. And she answered. And wow. That was like, that was pretty much it. Like, basically we talked and I was like, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And, what happened was I was going to, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dennis Dane or not, but, Dennis Dane was rode for WSA as well. He was like a great side hack guy back in the day. And you know, he won a few races. And so him and Stu and myself, we used to ride everywhere and ride all the time. Dennis would come pick me up. But what I did is I went to Dennis Dane's wedding. And after his wedding on a Saturday at like 11, I came straight to her house and then I stayed till like Monday morning and I came home. And then I got there and we hung out and we caught up, but it was like, you know, it was total respectful. Like, you know, I slept on top of the blankets and she was in the blankets and, you know, we just got to know each other and it was just, yeah, we haven't looked back. I think it's been, you know, close to 30 years now. So.
You were meant to be together.
Cool. Yeah, it's good stuff. It's totally cool. And I mean, like, if I can go back in time, I wouldn't change nothing. I wouldn't change her beating me. I would change nothing about it because all these experiences along the way kind of make the journey and then they create the character that you wind up being. Of course, if you could change a certain thing here and there, you would, but I wouldn't change anything on that deal. And I think if we would have got together early on, we may not have made it. Like, she didn't make it with her, you know, previous relationship, and I didn't make it with mine. And it's like, it takes a little bit of time to find out who you are.
Yeah. Maturity.
So you grow up, and I'm just really happy that I didn't grow up while we were together and then grow apart. Like, we already went through some stuff and we were able to get together, and, you know, it's been awesome. It's been great. So
not bad. Tell me this, your amateur career. Tell me if I'm wrong on some of these teams. Pedal Ready, okay. Pro Shop, GT, your dad owned the shop.
Yeah.
Webco, FMF, SE Racing, and Schwinn.
Yeah.
Am I in the ballpark?
You're right. Absolutely.
Okay. Tell me this then. What is the team that really catapulted you to national start as an amateur?
Well, like, there's other, I don't know if you mentioned these teams, but there's, like, there's Redline.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I rode Redline 3 different times. There's Mongoose. I rode for Mongoose for, I think it was 8 months, and I had to quit. I rode for Mongoose, and it was me and Roland Veit and Tinker Juarez and Kenny Knockman and Jeff Cosmala. And wow. They would put us all in one room. And it's like, after the fourth national, I came home and I told my dad, I said, I can't do this anymore, man. They were paying me $800 a month and then bonuses to win and paying all my expenses and stuff. I mean, I was like 16 years old living at home or something, you know, 17, whatever. But dude, I'd come home with contact high because, you know, like Roland Veit, who was a great guy, but he would pull a van shoebox out that didn't have shoes in it. And he would just roll one up and boom, it'd be like total Cloudville in our room. I thought I was staying with Cheech and Chong every time I went to a race. And
sorry, man, that's funny.
You know, no, I mean, it's great. It's even funnier now because right now, like for the last seven or 8 years, I smoke every night. I smoke a vape and it just helps me to sleep. And it's great. I don't go around getting high all day long. I don't wake and bake and smoke in the day. It's used for a reason. But when I first started doing it, I thought, what a hypocrite, man. I used to just want to like punch people for like doing that shit. And, but it's funny. So anyways, I had to get away from that team. And, the most, probably the biggest impact of being on a team would have been SC Racing. It would have been Scott Breidhop, because within that team was Scott Breidhop.
Yep.
Stu Thompson,
yep.
Jeff Utterback. Mm-hmm. Perry came as I was going. Love Perry. He's like a brother to me, a big brother. He's a great dude, but we never did like really hang out on the team very much together. Like I say, it just didn't overlap much. But what happened was I was able to be in a situation where basically there was the NBA Grand Nationals, and it was in 1976, that one. I think it was 76. And Scott Breidhop won the finals, which earned him the NBA National number one plate.
Wow.
That was in Costa Mesa, California, Orange County, California. And I remember riding my bike over to the sidelines about where the first jump is to sit and look through the chain link fence to watch that main event happen. And I watched that main event, and I turned around and I rode back to wherever my vehicle, my dad, my mom were there. And I said, that's it, man. I'm going to do that. That dude right there, I'm doing that. And from that point forward, it wasn't long, and I was on SC, and Scott was always there and always in my ear. And I got to go to races and watch Scott Breidhop, Stu Thompson, and, there was other guys, but I'm just going to say, if you're my age at the time, mm-hmm. 13, and you're getting to rub shoulders with Scott Breidhop and Stu Thompson, and you're on that team and you don't become great, there's a problem. There's a big problem. Like, you probably weren't paying attention. You probably didn't, you know what I'm saying? It's the most dynamic part of that whole gig is that while I'm saying all this at that period, right at that spot, Stu is dating my sister, my older sister. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately, I mean, they've been married over 40 years now, and you know, they, but like, this guy was family to me, but he was becoming the guy in BMX. I mean, there was, you know, David Clinton, there was John George, there was Scott Breidhop, then there was Stu. When Stu won the NBA title, the first one, I think he won in 77 and 78 because I won it in 79. When he won it in 77 is when all of a sudden we're going around the country racing all over the place. We're not racing in our backyard anymore. And then he's, you know, getting married to my sister. And I'm like now this 13, 14 year old kid who's racing, you know, amateur, and I'm seeing what Stu's doing. And, you know, I'm more mature today, so I could put it into words a little better. If you'd asked me this 25, 35 years ago, I couldn't have.
Yes, sir.
But as you age, you can put things together a lot better. And basically, I was able to watch Stu become the best BMX racer of his time. I was there watching it. I was part of it. And then at some point when I was 14, because I raced like amateur from 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, right? But when I was 14, I told my dad, I said, I'm done with this, man. I like raced 4 years where I was, I'm not trying to, when I say what I'm saying right now, I'm not trying to toot my horn, man. I'm really not. I'm not trying to say, look how great I was. I'm just trying to paint a scenario. I was winning all my races every weekend. And finally, after like 4 years, I told my dad, I said, I'm so sick of this, man. This sucks. I said, I would rather race pro and get last place than to race 14X and get first place. I'm done. Can we talk to Ernie or whoever? Ernie was the guy who started the NBA, right? So what happened is they allowed me to turn pro. They maybe get a couple signatures, and I don't know who signed my stuff, but I turned pro at 14. 6 months later, I want to make this clear because everybody gets this confused because everyone's like, Eric Roop. I love Eric Roop, by the way. He's like a brother to me. I love the guy. But he turned pro 4 or 5 months after I did, and we were both 14 racing pro. It was cool. But what we did is they let you race pro, and they let you ride your expert class till really? We were like six. Yeah, till we were like 16. Like I would race 14 expert, and I'd win, and then I'd go race pro. And then I would race 15 expert, and then I'd win, and then I'd go race pro. You know, there's a picture from Corona downhill when I was 15, and I'm on red line, and it's at the bottom of the hill, like the start hill. It's this very bottom before it comes up and puts you into the first turn. Mm-hmm. And I'm in front, and to my right is Stu. And I mean, everyone's in this photo. Stu, Anthony Sewell, Brent Patterson, Kevin McNeil. I mean, it's just stacked. And I actually won that day, and I won 15X and I won pro. So once we were 16, at some point they're like, all right, you race pro, you can't ride your amateur class. So I'm just rambling, man. I'm trying to remember the initial question, but rambling on there.
It's almost like it was the beginning of the pro-ams, if you don't mind.
It pretty much is. It's totally the beginning. Like I was at a race, and I remember when Scott Breithop was walking around. Yeah, Scott's the one I had to get it through. I'm sorry. Scott was walking around the track talking to all of the older amateur, the dudes that rode 14 and over open, all right? And he was getting them to sign, and he started this new thing called PRO, Professional Racers Organization. And it was PRO. They had a logo, and he's like, sign up. Just all you got to do is, you know, print your name, sign your name. And he had all these guys, and then he took that to – Ernie and said, we're starting the pro class. And that's when it started. And like, you know, so like I didn't get to sign that because I was still younger, but the next year I was like, I got to get in this, the man. And they were like, well, you just need three signatures. You get three signatures, you're in. And I got the signatures, and I went to my first pro race in Simi Valley, which is like 30 minutes west of me. And I'll never forget this. It was like, I'm in the main event, and I'm like, whoa, I'm in the main. And I'm going around the track, and I'm in fourth place, and I think they paid to third. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm right behind David Clinton, man. I'm like, oh, this is cool. And the next thing I know, I start hearing the noise like you hear when you get a back tire, flat tire, it starts rippling and you hear all the noise. David Clinton gets a flat, he pulls to the right. I just pull into third. I got third, I won $50. And I'm like, you know, this is pretty cool. You're winning $50 when you're 14. It's so awesome. Yeah, from that point forward, it was, I mean, I experienced the beginning of it. It's really crazy because I experienced the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. And then I rode through that and experienced the tail end of my career in 1988. I won an NBL pro title. And so when I look at, you know, 1970, 77, 78 to the 1988. In the years, like, I pretty much got to experience the inception of the pro class and then race through it. And, you know, it was cool. It was pretty interesting. I mean, the only bummer is that BMX never got enough traction to become, for whatever reason, people can debate this till hell freezes over, it seems like, but it just never became an opportunity to, if I would have done what I did in BMX, if I would have done that in motocross or, you know, tennis or golf or, you know, stick and ball sports professional, you know, and there's a lot of guys that could say this. So again, I'm not tooting my horn. I'm just saying, yeah, if I would have done that, the very least I would have had huge opportunities once you park the bike to get into that field of working in that environment. You don't have that in BMX. And then, you know, obviously the living you make is just so much different. So you race BMX and you do all these great things and people hold you up. But, you know, when you're done, you know, you got to park the bike, man. You got to figure out how to put food on the table because you're not getting that opportunity in BMX. It doesn't, you know, all these people used to think, oh, you made all this money. You know, I'm like, I don't really know what your perception of all this money is, but yeah, it's not what you think it is.
Yeah.
It's a great living, you know, but you're not making millions of dollars doing it. You know,
you're not making NFL money.
You're not making NFL money. You're not making Pro Bowlers Association money. You're not making, you know, nobody's raced BMX and made, you know, 400,000 a year, 500,000 a year. Nobody. I don't care what anyone says. No one's done that. Mayor Stromberg probably could say, hey, he's made more money racing BMX, but he came from a country that basically supported him, who he brought the first gold medal to, who hopefully they're taking care of him still. But, you know, there's really no one you can point to and say, this guy's set for life because of what he did. When I say set for life, I don't mean you don't have to get up every day and go out and do your job or go out and fight for what's yours. But there's what's more valuable than money is opportunities, because opportunities convert to money.
Yeah.
So, you know, the opportunities, once you park your bike, when you're done racing BMX, they are not there at all. You know, there's just not. And people say, well, GHP, you did so well. I said, yeah, me and 200 other frame companies. You're not selling 100,000 frames. You're not. You're selling, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 frames a year. That's doing, you're making a paycheck, man. You know, you're teaching clinics for 25 years. I loved doing that. And you're making, you know, some money, but the reward was the teaching and the magic of doing that. So it's not like, you know, nowadays you can see guys, I watch motocross a lot, and you know, you're looking into the announcements tower, and you're seeing guys like, you know, Ricky Carmichael and Jeremy McGrath, and you know, these guys have been able to have a great career. They set themselves up in their career, and when they park the bike, they got other opportunities. They represent brands. They do, you know, announcing and these kinds of things. So there's just not, those opportunities don't exist in BMX. That's, you know, that's the downside about it. You know, it's a great hobby.
Yeah.
But it's not a situation where, when my son Lauren was 14 years old, this is just an example of how I looked at it. I'm just going, I hope this is cool.
This is fine. Okay.
So we have a property I bought 25 years ago. We live on, it has a pump track out back. I haven't ridden it for 8 years. My grandkids ride it. But when I was just retired and teaching and fresh out of it, and I had friends come over. One time we had Harry Leary, Dale Holmes, Eric Roop, myself. We had like 7 or 8 other guys, all unbelievable guys, man. Like my son Lauren, out 14 years old, out in the back, just putting laps down that was just killing anybody else's laps. Unbelievable. And I'm sitting there going, and all these guys are like, holy shit, dude, you're kids ripping it up here. And I'm like, yeah. And so I'd talk to my wife and I'd be like, we got to really keep our eye on this dude because there's no opportunities in BMX. Okay. And, you know, when people listen to this, and I don't want them to misunderstand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that he doesn't have opportunity to turn pro, do well, and then get himself into life. But see, I've been there and done that. And I know when I was younger, when I was 20 years old, I probably had $200,000 in the bank. I, at that time, could have went out and I could have purchased 7 or 8 homes,
yeah,
maybe nine of them, by putting a down payment and having to manage a 1-month payment. And I could have just been managing properties. If someone would have pointed me in that direction, I would have done it. But what I did is I raced through all those opportunities. And by the time I was done racing, those opportunities were behind me. They weren't available anymore like that. Does that make sense?
It makes a little bit of sense. Yeah.
So my wife and I had these conversations, and Lauren was like, dude, he'd been in like, he would come to the clinics with me. He'd probably been in like 150 clinics. This dude was like just a sponge, you know? Yes. And I'd be hanging out at races and he'd be hanging around guys like John Purse and watching him win championships and hanging around guys that are all winning, and all these people, it just all rubbed off on him. And so the point of the story is we're sitting at a ABA Fall Nationals race at Lake Paris. And this is when clips started. This dude makes his main event. All the kids are clipped in except for him. He's in lane 8 and he freaking smokes everybody.
Damn.
And as he's coming down the last straight, I looked at my wife and I said, well, I'm going to have to talk with him. She's like, all right. All right. You know, because we're at the cusp of, wow, look what he just did, man. This could catapult him down the road of going to nationals, having sponsors. And just when you do that in BMX, you leave every other opportunity behind you. You don't do sports in school. Most people, you just race BMX,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So he came over and he had that big trophy and he was happy. And then a couple of days later, we were like, hey, listen, we're going to kind of chill BMX for a little bit. He's like, what? I'm like, you're getting ready to go to high school. We need to play high school sports and you need to be exposed to all that. And you could race a little bit too. But I said, it pains me to tell you this. There is no golden highway of opportunity in BMX. You're going to race yourself into, you know, a situation where if you have success here, you're going to get robbed of other opportunities that, because there isn't a huge opportunity going down this road. It's fun. You get exposure, you can do great things. But at the end of the day, there's no opportunity to take care of yourself long term.
Yeah.
So we got him into, I said, I'm going to give you a week. Pick what sport you want. School starts in 3 weeks. Pick a sport. Let's attack it. I'll help you. We'll make it happen. And he's like, all right. So he picked track and field, and he picked the long jump. So as soon as he's like, I'm doing the long jump, I'm like, get in the car, man. Let's roll. He's like, where are we going? I'm going, we're going to the library right now. So we went to the library and we got a book on track and field and long jumping. And our front yard just happened to be big enough to where I made a long jump pit. It had a path.
Wow.
We measured it out. We made it. We made the sand pit. It was exactly like what he was going to be doing. And on the third track meet of the year, he was going to a school that had been in business for like 49 years.
Yeah.
And the long jump had been set by like a senior, and he blew past that and broke the record. It was awesome. So it was just really about teaching him, hey man, let's duplicate this. Let's work our ass off. Let's not worry about it being hard. But remember, if it's not hard, then it's a freaking waste of our time. 'Cause who wants to deal with it? If it's not hard to do, let's not even look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was track and field and it was football, and he got to experience winning the CIF championships and being a running back. And he got to, you know, at a young age, he got into construction and he wound up being, you know, 20 years old and managing, you know, 8 guys on a construction company and being their boss because he got into it. He worked hard and, you know, he can build a house from A to Z right now. He can, you know, he's been a police officer now for 11 years and he's going to get his contractor's license. And so the whole point was, man, don't want to be wound up where I'm sitting. 'Cause you know what? I was sitting at a place where I was, you know, not sure what I was going to do. And there was no opportunity. And there was the, you know, the come to Jesus meeting I had. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. And I'm in, you know, I'm at the bottom of the barrel, man. And, I didn't want him to be there. You know, I didn't want him to deal with that.
You know, what was so interesting is when you say that is when you grow, when, like me, when you, I'm growing up and you see you on the cover or I see you at races, winning races, many, I would think many people like me are thinking, that guy is rolling in dough.
You know, the thing is at my best times, okay, I mean, I might have made 125, 150 grand a year. You know, what I got no complaints, man.
Yeah.
And like I said, I wouldn't change anything. But we did GHP the first time. And, you know, I mean, I funded it, man. I paid for it. You know, I didn't take a salary from GHP, but I had, you know, 15 sponsors that were all paying me every month. But I spent a lot of money, you know, on GHP. So I want to say I probably spent $250,000 on GHP. And when it got to a point after, like, we started in 83, and then 3 years later, it was like, hey, mom and dad, I'm just not going to put any more money in this. Well, we'll dip into our house. And I'm like, no, you won't. No, you won't. I don't need that kind of pressure. Don't want that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's just say it's been cool and let's move on. And, because I can't do it. And I got no more money to spend on this.
What was the problem?
And,
if you don't mind me asking, this is what I'm curious of. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it just came to me. When you started it the first time,
yeah.
What was the problem? Was the industry so saturated at that time?
No, it wasn't. It was actually, I'll try to say it as quick as I can. There was a problem where I was racing for GT bicycles. All right. When I started riding for GT, I was the first pro that they ever paid a dollar to. They'd never paid anybody before me. I started riding for them and it was a handshake deal and Richard Long took care of me. Yes, Gary Turner is the GT and Gary Turner and he's a great guy, super cool. But Richard Long, Gary Turner was the fabricator, the builder, the welder, the everything. Mm-hmm. And Richard Long was the visionary, the marketing guy. And so I started riding for them and I just was doing, it was just unbelievable. I was winning all these races. Well, after a couple of years, I wanted to buy a house and the bank says to me, hey, we need some verifiable income. You know, I need something. You can't just take your word on this. You're talking about a loan for a house. And it's like at the time the house was like 160 grand, you know, and you know, you have to have income verification. So I told my dad, I got to go talk to Richard. And my dad says, okay, here's the deal. Tell him. And this was like probably in May or June. Probably June. It was probably June of 1983. He says, tell them that you want a contract through the end of 1983 in paper and to reflect what they've been paying me ever since day one. That'll be enough for the bank to give you an honor and you alone. Okay, cool. Then my dad says, if he doesn't do that, then just tell him we're done. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And I never like really just, I'm not trying to throw my dad under the bus. God rest his soul. But, the point is the advice I got was really not the greatest. Like I'm going to literally sit across the table from this man and tell him, hey, I want a contract through the end of 83 so I can get this house. Well, Richard says, I'll tell you what, I'll one up you better on that. Let's put it in writing. I'll give you a contract and let's go through the end of 84. How many people wouldn't dig that? That's a great situation. I just got a 1 year extension. How cool. I said, I can't do that. He goes, are you kidding me? I said, I just need a contract through the end of 83. And here's what he said. He goes, Greg, I love you like a son. Okay. But if you go off and do your own bike company, I'm going to put you out of business, period. And that's what's going to happen. So you might want to think about this. Well, I went home, told my dad. My dad said some choice words, and it was like the next thing we know, we got a GHP prototype, and I'm going off to the races racing for GHP. That was that, man. 3 years later, you know, there's a lot of other things I don't want to really get into stuff because it's not important, but 3 years later, Richard's words rang true. We had issues that had nothing to do with the industry. We had issues from our vendor who was making our product, which was also in Santa Ana. And you know, the bottom line is what he said happened. We all of a sudden couldn't get frames, couldn't get product, and we were dead in the water. I was done. I actually called up and got a ride from Redline, and they sponsored me for like 6 months. And then Lynn Kasten called me up to go meet with him. I went to Newberry Park. He's like, we don't have any more money. I'm sorry, Gregory. We're done. We don't have it. We got nothing. And I'm like, wow, okay, I'm done. And one of my friends was like, you need to call Richard. I'm like, are you like completely stupid? Do you understand what I did to him? Like, I'm going to call him. And so my buddy's like, whatever, man. And he calls me up the next day. He says, "Hey, you need to call Richard right now." I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about? That's not happening." And he's like, "I just hung up with him and he wants to talk to you. Go see him."
Wow.
So I went to him and I sat across the table and he looked at me and he says, "Remember I told you I love you like a son?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Okay, so I want you to ride for Robinson. We just acquired the brand and I want to put you on Robinson." And I said, "Okay." And I went off and raced for Robinson. And the next year I won the NBL Pro title. And, he gave me a second chance, man. It was amazing. So
that is amazing considering what happened between you.
Richard Long was the coolest dude, man. He was the coolest guy. His passion for the sport, for life, he would literally stand at the finish line and be yelling. And if Sandy Finkelman, rest in peace, from Diamondback, or Roger Worsham from CW ever looked at him the wrong way, the dude would just walk over and pound their face in. He was like ready to do that. He was like, "We're going to kick their ass this weekend." he was amazing. And he really is why GT did what they did, basically. The marketing and the vision and everything he did is why they made it where they made it to.
Is there a title in your CV that sticks out most to you?
The 83 ESPN series was just, if someone said, "Hey, if you could only have one of your titles and everything had to be given back," I'd be like, "All right, just let me keep the 83 ESPN series title," because that was absolutely amazing. So
tell me this. What was the feeling of making the cover of magazines and all the pictures? Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it for sure. I think, there's not one person that has had that situation happen that they wouldn't say, "Hey, yeah, it stroked my ego." I mean, it made you feel good. It was, it was a great feeling. You're on the cover and it's like, wow, that's like it's an amazing feeling. Yeah, it's hard to put it in words, really. It's just, it's a very cool feeling as you get, when you're sitting in a certain place and you understand the dynamics of the business, it's a different place to be sitting in.
Yeah.
And if you're a fan sitting in, Tennessee somewhere, I'm just going to say this, Harry Levy made the cover again. Okay. That's everybody's loving it because everyone loves him. I'm not knocking him when I say this, but that's just the magazine's way of, let's keep getting those Diamondback dollars. We're giving them exposure. If anybody disagrees with that, they don't know what they're talking about. So what happens at a certain point is that you realize the magazine is trying to make sure they take care of all their advertisers.
Yeah.
Don't for one minute think you're so special that they put you on the cover because they love you, because that's not the case. Even though I have a great relationship with Osborne to this day, love the man. It's a business. He's running a business and he's got to make money. He's got to make sure you're not seeing, the local hot shoe from, Midwest somewhere making the cover, riding for Joe's Bike Shop. He's not making the cover. Why? Well, it's not his fault. He's not making the cover because Joe's Bike Shop's not running ads.
Yeah.
They don't have $100,000 advertising budget to run ads. So they're not going after that guy.
Wow.
That's kind of how it works,
You did some racing in the UK. I'm curious of your thoughts on that.
It was the most horrible experience racing over there. It was cold, wet. It was mud. It was just, and not to mention, you're racing 35, 40 weekends a year over here, and then you're trying to find some downtime somewhere, and, "Oh, we got to go to the UK and race for 2 weeks." It's like, that place sucks. Okay, if you're going to the UK to go hang out, it's awesome, man. There's so much history over there. But if you're going there to race, good luck finding a time when it's nice and bright and sunny out and the track is perfect, and it's just not happening. And then you're on the gate racing dudes that are like, pretty fast, but they're not on your level. And it's not because they can't be. It's just because they're over there racing, 10 nationals a year. And we're over here racing 50 nationals a year. And we're, So you're going over there and these guys are mud specialists and you're in their backyard. It's just, I didn't enjoy it so much. The Kellogg series, I had an opportunity to go back and I was like, "No, I'm good. Thanks." You know, I just didn't like it. And the first one of the tracks we went to, we were in our bus. They had one of them big buses that, you know, you like a Greyhound, but like a passenger bus type thing. And we were really, really close to the border of up north, like Scotland, I think it was. Man, there was kids throwing rocks from, like, they were bouncing them off the freaking bus, and we were getting thrown rocks at us. We were riding the track, and it was just like crazy, and it was wet. And then one of the tracks we went to, like the first, we had a 6-race or a 7-race series that all took place in like 9 days. So we're racing every day, basically. And the first track we went to had a gate that was just tubed. There was no wood on it. There was no mesh on it. It was, say it was 1 foot high, and it was just tubing. So your tire kind of went in it, and it slipped a lot. And I was on, I think, the inside lane. And just before the gate drop, my tire slipped to the left. I leaned forward, and in order to not fall down the side of the hill, I put my foot down right as the gate slammed on my big toe and broke it. And then I had to race, you know, the rest of the races like that. And it was just like, this whole thing, please let me not ever come back here again.
Wow. Let me ask you this, yeah, Greg. Do you think in your time of racing as a pro, do you think you raced too much?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we raced NBL and we raced ABA, and then we raced any independent race that popped up, like the Rondo Classic or like other shit like that. And we were just racing all the time. And it's a lot, you know. I always kind of felt like when later on in my career, and then when I retired and hear all the other current pros, they're always pitching for less races. There's too many races. And I'm like, you guys have no clue what too many races is, man. When you're sitting, you know, at a national in the middle of the summer, and you've already raced like, I don't know how many, man, 20 weekends, and you got another 20 weekends or 25 weekends to go, and it's freaking hot and you're tired, and, you know, like, it's just too much, man. It was too much.
Looking from the outside in, let me ask you that question.
Yeah.
What do you think of BMX at this moment?
I want to say what I feel, and I don't want the listeners to think, oh, this guy's a total dick. You know, it's like, I want them to understand why I'm saying this. So I think the state of BMX right now sucks. Okay. And here's why. Because on the one side, you got the UCI and you got these Olympic events and these big, huge tracks that basically not even 1% of the BMX community can ride on. Not 1%. Mm-hmm. Okay. You got little Johnny sitting at home who probably rides BMX and is like, yeah, I'm going to make it to the Olympics one day. And they sit down and watch BMX Olympics on the TV, or they go on the internet and watch some of these UCI events. And pretty soon, little Johnny's mom and dad are like, yo, dude, you're not going to do that. This dude just flew off in a helicopter. You see that crash on that asphalt berm? That guy's done. Like, there's too much danger in it. Right. So when you go to the typical local track, there's tracks are just so different everywhere. And so this is what I've been saying for years and years. And for the last 5 years, thank God I haven't had to say it because I've been out of BMX. So it's just behind me. But you look at a BMX track, and really it should be like a franchise. You know, it should be like, whether you like Subway or not, we'll just use it as an example. Yeah, you got a Subway restaurant in Minnesota and you got one in California. And if I blindfold you and put you inside the store, you're not going to know what state you're in because it's a Subway and it's franchised and it's all the same. And so there's the main corporation manages that and makes sure that everything's done the way it should be done. Right. Well, in BMX, you don't have that. You have a sanctioning body, the USA BMX, that doesn't know anything other than let's just roll in this 18-wheeler and take signups and run a national. But, you know, they haven't been to, you know, like I used to be friends with the people that run Simi Valley Track. It's been gone now for a few years. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to the track operator, and I said one time, because I used to give lessons out there, I said, hey, Tony, when is the last time the ABA has been here? And he looked at me and laughed. He goes, are you kidding me? I've been running this track for 18 years. I haven't seen them once out here. They don't care, man. They don't tend to the local scene. They don't help the local scene. They don't make sure that tracks are all uniformly the same. to where they should have some type of guidelines to a track where, you know, here you are, you're a track operator and here's your kit. And this is, you know, I'm not saying they all have to be exactly the same. There's just no management. BMX has never reached its potential and there's a lot of reasons for it. And you can spend all day talking about how, well, you know, there's electronics and there's this and there's that. Yeah, that's cool. That sounds great until you're saying, well, how come you can fill a baseball stadium with 50,000 people and you can watch professional guys playing baseball? Well, those guys were probably kids that played on electronics. How'd they make it here? Well, they made it here because if they do well in baseball, they can get their education paid for and get a degree and go into business. And if they're one of that small percentages that make it all the way, they're going to get drafted and their contract's going to be worth a few million before they ever touch the field.
Yeah.
That's why they're here. Why do we fill the stands? Because we want to see a guy who gets paid $7 million a year hit the ball over the fence. It's just cool. That's why people go. You don't see that in BMX. It hasn't happened. And it's just BMX is a great hobby. It's a great family sport. But the people that run it are just rodeo rednecks who don't know their head from a hole in the ground. I'm sorry. You got Shannon Gillette. You got John David. You got B.A. Anderson. I can go down the line. I don't really care. You know, I'm not too worried about if they like what I have to say or not. These guys are all getting paid and they're sleepwalking at nationals. They just go in and take the money and they go. They don't worry about the service and the product. They don't try to grow it. And that's just what it's been. And I don't know that it'll ever change.
If you had an opportunity to have an influence on how it's run, what would you do?
Well, I would be like the guy who bought a business, who walks in and just guts the business of all the employees, and I'd start over. That's no business plan, no like long time. Hey, man, we're going to buy this thing and we're going to like basically spend the next 2 weeks cleaning shop. That's what I would do, you know, but I don't see any scenario where I'll ever be back in BMX like to that degree at all. But, you know, I just think that you got a group of people that just only think about one thing. Let's get as many, I mean, let's be honest, anybody listening to this, I challenge anybody who's listening to this. Tell me I'm wrong. Prove me I'm wrong. I'm listening. Does the ABA care about anything other than getting more motos at nationals? Do they care? I mean, they just had nationals in the last 12 months that had 400 motos where guys are racing at 10, 11 o'clock at night and they don't care. And I asked Bernie Anderson once, who, by the way, I've been friends with for not anymore. I haven't talked to him, but Bernie Anderson, the man who bought the ABA. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was at the ABA Grands probably 20 years ago. And I said to him, hey man, you got 650 motos or whatever. What's going to happen when you have 1,000 motos? How are you going to do this? And he just smiled at me and he says, oh, believe me, we'll do it. We'll figure it out. And it's like, don't you think that if you kind of remove novice, beginner, intermediate from the nationals and you let just the girls and the cruisers and the experts and the pros race, don't you think you'd basically have smaller nationals and then those people that really love racing would go to their local track to try to get good enough to get to that point where they could race a national? Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. And it's not, okay, you're right. I don't know what I'm talking about. So it's just embarrassing how they run it. It really is. And it hasn't changed. And they got this new marketing guy that's running the show now. He's in charge. I see nothing different. They have nationals and they have huge moto count and I talked to a buddy of mine that went to a national this year and he said that basically they canceled, they don't have practice on Saturday morning anymore. They just run the national. So you're pretty much, you know, taking time off work, taking time off school, going to a national, spending all this money. You're getting hardly any practice time and let's just get as many people as you can. And it's like, it just makes no sense to me. So
do you miss the racing at all?
No, not at all. Nothing about it. I miss seeing people I know and hanging out and all the dumb things that happen along the way. But I don't miss the, I raced a long time, man. I don't miss the laps. I, can remember what a good lap felt like, and I remember the good races. And I actually raced in 2015. I raced at the opener and made the main and got, I think I got sixth. I raced in flats, everybody else on clips. Won my first moto, got fourth in the semi, got fifth or sixth in the main. Then went to Arizona for the Winter Nationals and clipped in for that and got first on Saturday. And I didn't race the whole weekend because, like, for instance, on Saturday, I was transferred out of my first moto at like 1:45 or 2 o'clock. And then we didn't have a semi. So I didn't do anything until like 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. I had to go race my main. It was like unbelievable. It was so unbelievable. And then after that, then I went to Ventura and the same deal, transferred out first round, 8 hours later, go to race my main. I won Phoenix and I won Ventura, and racing guys like Billy Griggs and Eric Roop and Eric Sweets and a bunch of different dudes. And then I went to New Mexico, and that was the fourth one I raced, and I crashed on Saturday, and I was just like, it was the hardest crash I ever had in my life.
Wow.
Ever in racing. That's and I was just like, this is like, this doesn't need to happen again. And then people were like, you got to race again. And you got to go to, you know, they had this Frogtown race over the weekend. I couldn't go because I wanted to go so bad. Not to race. I just want to go to the event. But I have two of my grandkids have the birthday on the same day. And it's on the 10th of September, which is Saturday. I'm not going to miss birthdays to go to that. But it's like, people are like, you got to come race. I'm like, I'm not racing again. I'm never racing again. It looked fun. I'll go have like hang out on the sideline and drink a beer and yell at people and cheer for you. And I'm not racing again. I'm not going to roll a pedal in the name of fun and dislocate my shoulder or break my femur. And, you know, and now I can't go take care of my business, which is doing epoxy flooring. I can't go do a job if I'm sitting here on the couch broken, you know?
Yeah. So tell me this. What are your thoughts on flats to clips?
I just think that clip pedals just make the racing a lot more velodrome style, less contact. What people seem to not understand is that clips are a huge advantage until everyone's clipped in. And then now there's no more advantages. Everybody just stepped up a couple notches. You're going to have faster lap times. But because everybody's using them, everybody's faster now, there's no advantage. What you just did is screwed over the whole aspect of racing. And I have people have looked at me when I say that, and they think, well, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And I'm like, okay, let me tell you why I'm saying this. Here's why. I was at a national. It was at Burbank, California, and it was in the 90s. And Mike King and Brian Lopes, who were great riders, great guys, super nice. They're going to hate me for saying this, but whatever. They didn't win a whole lot in BMX. You know, Lopes never won a number one pro title in BMX, and Mikey won one. And that was because he brought his points in from being in the A pro class, or let you bring those points up and then race double A pro. And if they would have not done that, which they shouldn't, he would have never known what it was like to win a number one pro title. So I'm not bagging on them. I'm just saying,
yeah,
they were fast. They weren't top runners. Okay. So these dudes showed up in Burbank and they were clipped in and nobody else was, and nobody else clipped in the whole entire weekend. And they got first and second both days. And then everybody clipped in and they were back in fifth and sixth again. Win an occasional race, win an occasional lap, but they wound up settling back in to where they were originally. So now at the expense of physicality, bumping, rubbing his race, and now we're all clipped in and we're doing velodrome laps. And, you know, it's just, I think clips just have killed the whole point of BMX. You watch some of these races online on social media of Frogtown, and you see these guys having a great time bumping, physical. You're not doing that with clip pedals. It's not happening with clip pedals, you know?
You used to do a little bit of coaching. Are you still doing that at all?
Yeah, I taught for 22 or 23 years. I don't do any. When I got out of BMX 5 years ago, and I just dropped everything. I just completely got out. Got out and just decided to start a new path. And I just couldn't do it anymore.
What is that?
You know, when path? I was doing, I own an epoxy flooring business. I do 99% of my jobs are garage floors. I do garage floors like, you know, one car, two car, three car, four car, that kind of stuff. Patios, walkways. you know, the GHP van is now the Epoxy Surface Professionals van. Seats are out and all my tools and equipment are in there, and yes, I roll up and I just do, you know, I do, that's what I do for a living. Just, I'm licensed, insured, and bonded, and I don't have employees. I work alone. I usually try to do 2 to 3 jobs every week, and just try to not be on the hamster wheel, if you will, but do, you know, enough jobs to make a living, to be happy.
You enjoy the business?
Yeah, I do. It's kind of a, you know, I told my wife before my first job, I said, this is great. I'm going to go and I'm going to roll up and the dude's not going to know who I am. He's not going to, you know, ask me to hook him up like everybody in BMX does. I'm just going to go do a floor and come home. And she's like, yeah, that's awesome. And this is funny because I had a guy helping me when I first started. I had a helper for like a year or so, just so I could kind of ease my way, learn everything. And then after a while, I just started doing it on my own. So I go to my first job, get there, get my buddy that was helping me, gets all the, you know, he unloads and gets everything set up while I'm talking to the owner. And the guy says, now mind you, this is the first job I'm doing, starting a new business, wanting BMX to be in my rearview mirror. Not because I hate BMX, just because it's time to do something different. I'm standing there and the guy says, hey, I got a question. I noticed on the bid, it says Greg Hill. And he goes, are you the BMX Greg Hill? Oh. I'm like, thinking, in my mind, I'm like, damn it. You know, like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? And he's like, dude, I had a GT. I bought a GT because you had one and this and that. And the next thing you know, I'm just going, dude, I'm thinking, I'm trying to get away from this shit. This dude is sitting here. We're talking about BMX right now. It's like, I don't want to, you know? So I'm like, yeah, man, you know, that's cool. Awesome. That's great. Blah, blah, blah. And I got home and told my wife and we were just laughing. It was funny.
Oh man, that is so, that's a good one.
But yeah, it's just you know, it's a normal, regular living now. And yeah, I bust my ass, I get sore, I get tired, and I don't have any politics in it. And I'm, you know, since I started doing this, I'm home every weekend. I'm home every night, my own bed. I don't have a bunch of politics crap like I dealt with. Like, it's just so much bull crap in BMX in terms of when you're trying to run a business within the industry and you're dealing with the sanction and you're trying to do all that. And then, you know, I'm teaching and you're gone a lot and it's just tough, man. It's hard because you have to do like 3 different things to get the income you need to make it.
Yeah.
And those 3 different things don't leave you any extra time, you know?
So you don't envy any of the young pros that are now doing it?
No, I feel sorry for them. I do. And the reason why is because I feel sorry that you know, that they love something so much, which I can totally relate to. It's not like, it's not wrong that they do. I'm just trying to say that they love something so much that can't love them back and provide any kind of future. And when you're young, you're kind of blinded by your passion and your love for something. And, you know, you're not really thinking that when you know, I got to be honest, I looked at the USA BMX pro standings a couple months ago. I didn't know anybody except for 1 or 2 people. But I see photos and I see pictures of guys on the podium with, you know, a check for, you know, $900 or $1,100. And I'm thinking, or I see a UCI race where it's a UCI World Cup and the winner gets like whatever it is, $2,000 or $3,000. And there's only 5 races a year, 6 races a year. I think these guys are giving everything they have to a sport that's given them nothing. And as a matter of fact, they're going to basically, when they get older, they're going to get out of bed every single day and they're going to be reminded of what they used to do because their body's going to be, you know, telling them as they're going to the coffee pot how sore they are. I mean, you're just in a situation where there's no future. So when you get to a point where you have to really think about building a life for yourself, you're not going to be able to do that in BMX. And I'm sure that a lot of people listening are going to say, wow, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Connor Fields has done good. And, you know, some of these guys have done good. Okay. Let me just say, probably 20 guys over the course of the last 10 years have made some money. They haven't made a future. Connor Fields is a great guy. One of the best to ever do it. He can't just hang out and do nothing. He's riding the coattails of a great career right now and probably has sponsorship from that. It's not going to take care of him long term. He's going to have to find some other way to leverage what he did into an opportunity. And I hope that he does. But there's a lot of guys out there that are like, tell me if you know. I want to know. Who's the number four BMX pro right now? Who got the number four plate last year? Did they make $32,000 last year as a living? Probably. You know, you're getting fifth place at a national and you're probably winning $400. You know, how can you live on that? You can't. And then, you know, there's no pro open class. So we used to get paid contingency bonuses for open and pro cruiser. You don't have pro cruiser anymore. You don't have pro open anymore. So you have one class, you know, and how do you make a living doing that? It's a pretty sad deal, to be honest. It really is.
Last couple of questions. I'm curious of your thoughts from being at the pinnacle of the sport. What makes a good BMX racer?
I think if you're going to be a great BMX racer, mm-hmm. you're going to have the ability to shut off the outside world and to focus on where you want to go. And you're going to have to dig deep. It has nothing to do with talent. Zero. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of guys that can put laps down that'll just blow your mind with talent. It's amazing. But most of those people don't want to do the work that it takes to get to that first jump 6 inches ahead of that natural talent. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to give you an example right now. And again, my examples are not bagging on anybody. I totally like respect Brian Foster. And I think the guy's one of the best riders that's ever done it, ever. Right. But he never won any pro titles. And then someone might say, well, he won X medal, X games. Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool story. That's a whole nother sport. It's not BMX racing. He never won a BMX title in BMX in racing. And the reason why is because all he ever did is go to the trails. And he's the guy that could be sixth place coming out of the first turn, oftentimes was, and passed two people in the first turn and passed another two or three people before the finish and had the great skills to go with it. But if the guy would have been an athlete, he would have dominated BMX. So, you know, it isn't about talent and skill. It's about dedication, sacrifice, and working your ass off and doing the things that you don't necessarily think are fun. You know, that's what it's about. So
is there anyone that you would thank for your success?
Yeah. You know, when I look at it, like at the very beginning, because if you're doing something and you have great success, you have to follow that back to the point where you started it and who helped you to get you pointed down that road, you know? Mm-hmm. And without that, you wouldn't have ever done it probably. So my sister Tanya, who's married to Stu, when I first started to go, I went to the races to watch my buddy. I came home, told my parents about it. They're like, yeah, we don't really have time. You know, we can't really take you to the races. I'm sorry. So I went with my buddy a few more times. And then my sister Tanya was like, I'm taking him. And she's like 6.5 years older than me. So if I was like 10, she was already had her license and driving. So dude, she had a VW and she would throw my bike in there and we go to the track. And after a couple of times to the track, she actually met Stu and she wanted to go to the track 8 days a week. And that was great, you know? So for me, she was there. My parents did get into it later, but my sister took me when no one else was, you know, and that was, if you don't have that, and you don't have that person that starts you off in the beginning, then you don't have anything coming later down the line. And so I have to say she's really, I owe her, you know, she's really one that made it. And then you got people along the way that give you opportunities. So the difference between opportunities and someone just doing it, my sister didn't have any stake in making money off of me. I could say that, oh, I want to thank Lynn Casson, but why? He sponsored me for one reason, so he could sell bikes. I don't need to thank him for that. You know, he sponsored me because he could sell product. Every sponsor I ever had sponsored me because they wanted to sell product, because they wanted the benefit of having a top guy using their products. That's cool, but it's not like what my sister did. It's not like a guy named Jeff Spencer, who Jeff Spencer was a motocross trainer. He trained Jeff Ward, David Bailey, top guys. That guy started training me in 1983, trained me for free for 4 months in 1983. And that was enough to turn everything around for me. And he didn't expect a dime and didn't ask for anything. And he did it out of the goodness of his heart. Wow. I appreciate that. That's awesome. But, you know, opportunities are usually laced with opportunity on both sides of the fence. So as much as I can thank Lynn, he can thank me. As much as I can thank Skip Hess from Mongoose, I wrote for him for 8 months. You know, he can thank me as well. I can thank Gary Turner and Richard Long, but let's be honest. I started racing for them when they were in a building, a small building, and we started winning. And within 2 years, they moved four different times into bigger buildings, selling more product. It was because they were doing everything right, but they also had a rider who was out there winning, who they marketed. So it was a win-win for both of us, yeah. Right? And it's just, there's a lot of people that were cool along the way, but I'm going to just leave it at my sister. She basically saw a kid who was troubled, who fought every day, who went to three different elementary schools getting kicked out for fighting every day, and pretty much said, this guy isn't going to make it far if he doesn't have an outlet. And she took me. And that was cool.
My last question to you, Greg Hill, is this. Looking back at your life, from waking up this morning to looking back, from growing as a man, being an elite BMX pro, marrying the love of your life, do you feel blessed? Yes or no, and why?
Yes, absolutely. I feel blessed. The first thing I try to do when I get up in the morning is thank God for my life, because without God, I'd have nobody. I fully believe in God. I'm not trying to preach, to each his own for everybody, but God breathed life into my lungs, and here I am. And, I thank him every day for that. So, you know, I'm blessed. And I'm trying to be grateful. A good buddy of mine, who's not in BMX, once told me, he says, you know, I was talking to him, he's a successful contractor and did well for himself. And the business is very hard, you know. And he says, you know what I do every day when I get up, this is what gets me through my day and through my weeks and months and years, is I get up and I go and look at my kids when they're in bed sleeping. I walk back down the hall and I look at my wife, and then I tell myself, thank you, God. This is the reason I'm going out there today. I'm going to kick ass, you know? And it's like, that's so cool, because without your family, you have nothing. Without, in my opinion, without God, you have nothing. So I try to keep it real and thank God for all the things I have. I thank him a lot of times even more for the things I don't have and for the things that I feel are so shitty. Like when people say, oh man, this always happens, or this, like, when everything crappy happens, I just, first thing I do right out of the gate when something shitty happens, I thank God. When I was going to get into epoxy, I had no idea I was getting into epoxy. I was in my bedroom. The door was shut. I was next to my bed and I was in tears. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew GHP was done. We shipped the last frame. I was checking out of BMX and had no idea what I was doing at all. Okay. And I was in tears and I said, God, thank you. You know, I'm at the very bottom. Things suck and I'm giving thanks. Dude, thank you. Because everything that's happened is an experience. And this moment right here that I hate is a great experience, because this moment's going to build character. I'm going to come out of this room swinging and I'm going to make it. But I had to be here to appreciate everything that's happened. So, you know, I thank God. He's, without him, I got nothing.
Wow. Thank you, Greg Hill. I really appreciate you giving me some time on Lane 8 BMX podcast. It has been a true treat to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. And good talking with you, and appreciate you letting me part of your program there.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.